You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, your day-to-day anger can be a problem or it can be a tool to learn more about yourself or your life. We'll talk to a Wisconsin anger expert about the deeper meaning behind being angry. Now, schools around the state have been opening their doors for the new academic year. And going into the new year, all but one school district opted into an extension of the federal government's seamless summer option of providing free meals to students during the pandemic throughout the whole year. Waukesha, in a close vote earlier this week, decided to reverse course and opt back in to the program. We're going to explain a little more of what these programs are and look at free and reduced school lunch a little more broadly as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the Waukesha story or participating in it? What thoughts do you have? Do you think they made the right call opting back into that program? Has your family at some point used free and reduced school lunch? What does it mean to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Ruiz is Associate Director for Research at Epistemic Analytics Lab at the UW Center for Education Research and a fellow in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics in the UW-Madison School of Education and School of Medicine and Public Health. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
There are a few different layers of school lunch assistance. I want to untangle them a little bit. First of all, can you tell us what was in place before we had heard of COVID-19? What was the state of school lunches and federal support for them?
Sure. So most of what supports meals in schools comes through what's known as the National School Lunch Program and the School Breakfast Program, which allows schools to provide breakfasts, lunches, and afternoon snacks. At three different levels. So they can provide free meals at one level, they can provide a reduced price meal at a second level, or they can provide an unsubsidized meal at the third level. And those levels are determined by essentially means testing, by determining the income of a given family, a student's family, and determining whether they qualify for a free or a reduced price meal. And basically the way that works is that the school then gets a different reimbursement rate depending on which kinds of meals they're serving.
Along comes the pandemic now and concerns about if kids aren't going to school, they're not having access to the lunch. What happens in the summer? Are more people needing lunches even though they might not be eligible yet? What kind of policy changes came along with that, Andrew?
Yeah, so with the pandemic, we saw a lot more students become food insecure due to parents who lost jobs or had fewer hours and so on. And as a result, the USDA, which is the federal agency that administers school meal programs, essentially made it possible for schools to provide free meals to all students, regardless of the financial situation of any particular student. And this is the first time in the 75-year history of the National School Lunch Program that there have been, temporary or otherwise, universal free meals for all students.
And we had this thing called the seamless summer option, but it kind of blurs into the rest of the year, too. Can you sort that out for us?
Sure. It's a little bit complicated, but the program involves a number of different sub programs, one of which is the seamless summer option, which allowed schools to provide meals during the summer months when most schools would typically not be in session, or for year-round schools to provide meals during their vacation periods. And the way that particular program works is that if 50% of a student population would qualify for free or reduced price lunches, then the schools could provide free meals to all students, during the summers. And the community eligibility program does the same thing for during the school year, if at least 40% of the students would otherwise qualify for free or reduced price lunches, and the school can provide free meals to all students. And what happened during the pandemic was essentially that same ability was just extended to all schools, mainly by raising reimbursement rates and a few other mechanics of the programs to make it possible for any school to do this and not have to worry about certifying students.
Now, with that under our belts, let's visit Waukesha, which made national news. And I think some of the postings I saw on social media, Andrew, I think made it look like Waukesha was considering getting rid of all free or reduced lunch programs, even the stuff that was there before. As I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, they're deciding whether to keep this universal one where everybody can get the free lunch regardless of their economic background, the means testing, or going back to the pre-pandemic state affairs where only kids with economic eligibility could get the free and reduced lunch. Is that right?
Yeah. So my understanding, and again, I can't speak to the school board meeting itself. My information comes from the media as well. But my understanding is that what Waukesha was proposing to do was to revert back to the standard National School Lunch Program, rather than this special COVID-based program that would go through June of next year. And in doing so, essentially what that would mean is that they would no longer be able to offer universal free meals to all students. It would go back to that three-tiered program where some students would qualify for free meals, some would qualify for reduced price meals, and all the other students would pay the full price. And so, you know, the decision was, essentially to forego continuing to participate in this universal free meal program, this temporary program in the current academic year.
We're talking to Andrew Ruiz with UW Center for Education Research. He's looked a lot at school lunch programs over the years. We are talking about what they are, how they work, new programs during the pandemic that made school lunches available for free to all students at participating schools. And that's pretty much all schools in Wisconsin. Some controversy, a back and forth in Waukesha. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on school lunch programs. What do you think of this idea of, hey, you show up at school, you're a student, you're eligible for a free lunch. You don't have to show proof that you need it or anything like that. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Wisconsin State School Superintendent Jill Underle was on the morning show earlier this week. Jake Carlisle Larson asked her about the Waukesha story. They're reconsidering the initial decision at the time. Here's some of what the DPI superintendent had to say.
There's so much stigma, of course, attached to that. For people who maybe were on free and reduced lunch, and schools have eliminated that stigma. And I think, you know, by providing the meals to all kids this year, as the U.S. Department of Agriculture has, I think that also takes steps at eliminating the stigma, but also ensuring that every child has what they need to succeed every day.
Can you talk about that idea, Andrew, of there being a stigma of being the kid who gets the free lunch, and whether giving the free lunch to all the kids is a good way to tackle that?
Yeah, and this has actually been a concern, going back more than 100 years. Even in the very earliest school meal programs, the architects were concerned about this issue of stigmatization of students who were essentially receiving a kind of charity or a kind of state welfare, being embarrassed or stigmatized as a result. And so schools have traditionally faced that in various ways. Some use like a ticket system to make sure that, you know, every student is using the same ticket when it comes to pick up their food. And so you can't tell the difference between the students who paid for that ticket and those who received it for free, and so on. But as we've seen in recent years, there have been major, major issues with stigmatization. So many people have been following the news, have heard about lunch shaming or school lunch debt. And this happened when, students who were unable to pay for lunches, either because they didn't qualify for the free or reduced price lunches, or they did qualify and just didn't get the paperwork in time, were given a different lunch than other students, and that could create a kind of stigma. Or there were stories about school districts having to use debt collection agencies to go after families who had outstanding lunch debts, and that. That was really detrimental, not only for students, but also for cafeteria workers who, had to be the ones to actually, implement, these policies. And one of the real benefits of universal free meals is that it takes all of that off the table because there's nobody paying for food. You don't have to worry about, who's receiving free meals and who isn't, because everybody's receiving free meals. You don't have to worry about lunch debt anymore because now there's no individual payment. And so a lot of the biggest issues when it came to stigmatization and shaming really just go away with a universal program.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I wanted to mention that I am actually a graduate of Waukesha South High School, class of 2013, and was a student who depended on the free and reduced lunch program. Mom worked nights, single mom, and so it wasn't always easy clearing these things out. And it was a necessary part of, the lifestyle, just making sure that I got a meal at lunch every day. And it's just unsurprising that Waukesha School Board made headlines again with these policies. It's just reoccurring that these administrators seem to think that these students are part of a system that it's not cooperative, it's not productive always. And I just hope that listeners out there might realize, there's a lot more students affected by the free and reduced lunch program than could ever be imagined.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Andrew, what do you think of what John had to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely right. I mean, Waukesha, for example, had about a 9% rate of child hunger in 2019, and it went up to 13% in 2020, which means there's a significant number of students in Waukesha who absolutely, like John, probably depend on being able to get at least one, if not two, of their meals, every day in school. And it's a big deal to be able to have access to that kind of program.
That call, John. We're talking to Andrew Ruiz from the UW Center for Education Research, looking at the National Universal Free School Lunch Program being extended beyond the summer, how Waukesha schools first opted out, then opted back into that program. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have school-age kids or grandkids, what's your family's experience been like with meals in school or over the summer? Were you able to use this universal option? Do you think it's not a good use of resources to provide free meals, even if the kids' families can afford it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with school lunch historian and researcher Andrew Ruiz from UW-Madison, looking at the nationally funded universal free meals in schools. It's been extended into the new academic year. You can join in with your thoughts, experiences, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Andrew, I think one concern here is that, given finite resources for schools and when it comes to federal funding, is money to feed kids whose families could afford the food already, is that money well spent or could it be used in a better way?
Well, one of the things that research has shown is that universal meal programs really do have a lot of benefits. They reduce food insecurity, improve children's diets, improve academic performance, even potentially improve future earnings. And so the benefits to society are pretty substantial. Those are things that are really well worth investing in, not to mention the immediate benefits to children who otherwise might go hungry, as John was mentioning, the previous caller, and benefits to their parents, their families, and particularly to mothers as well.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Vivian joins us now in Green Bay. Vivian, hello.
Hello. I have some personal experience with not having lunch money. So I'm 76, very poor background, ate my sandwich in the bathroom because I had lard on delightfully homemade bread. But I also worked in elementary schools for 25 years, and it's not just the kids who financially can't afford it. It's the children whose parents have the income, but maybe they're spending it somewhere else. And the child gets there, and the lunch program is mandated to feed them something, even if their account balance is zero. So the child was often offered a peanut butter sandwich, a fruit and a milk, which is excellent, but the other children knew darn well why that youngster had peanut butter sandwich and milk. And dad might be driving a Cadillac, but they weren't taking care of the business of their children.
Vivian, thanks for the call with that experience. Andrew, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things to keep in mind, and this is really true of any public health program, but particularly of programs that are nutritional programs for children, is that, you know, there are really cases where the state is taking some responsibility over the health of children, so some responsibility that might otherwise be situated in the home. And this is a perfect example of why, you know, we live in a world where we think that's important to do, is that, you know, we're seeing kids at school 6-7 hours a day, and we want to make sure that at least while they're there, that they're well cared for. And it really shouldn't just be about income. It really shouldn't just be about whether we can demonstrate inconclusively that a student needs that support. We really should live in a world where we just provide that nutritional support for children, and that's a really good example for why.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Andrew Ruiz from the UW Center for Education Research, looking at school lunch programs, universal school lunch programs introduced during the pandemic. So all kids are eligible in schools that take that program up, not just kids who demonstrate a financial need. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and experiences. We'll go back to your calls now. Rose is with us in Toma. Rose, hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. One thing that I thought of is when I was in college, I learned that out of all the techniques and so on that had been used in education, that the thing that improved scores more than anything else was feeding the children. So to me, that means that my tax dollar is really doing a whole lot of good if I feed the children. So that was one, and I've seen that. It's heart-wrenching to watch a meal be thrown in the trash and a peanut butter sandwich given. And then, you know, our legislators that just came out and said we're going to spoil our children by feeding them seems a little extreme. So,
Rose, thanks for the call. Andrew, what do we know about children who are fed versus children who are hungry when it comes to their educational outcomes?
Yeah, and you know, again, for more than 100 years, this has been, you know, one of the arguments in favor of school lunch programs, is that, you know, well-fed children do perform academically much better. They can take advantage of education in much better ways, and that has real benefits for society. And you know, this other notion, though, this idea that, you know, students or their families will somehow, you know, be spoiled or develop some kind of addiction to, you know, this access to free food has also been a very old, argument against those programs. But it's never been borne out. Research does suggest that these kinds of programs have real tangible benefits for students and for society.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Martha now in Menominee. Martha, hello.
Yeah, it shows you how out of touch these school board members are that talk about, could the money be better spent for families that can afford it? You know, who cares? These kids go in, they get everybody gets a free meal. Nobody's keeping score on who's getting a free lunch, who's getting a reduced lunch. Who has money? Whose family has money to pay for their lunches? You know, it puts all the kids on an even playing field psychologically. And when you're a child and you have enough peer pressure in school, if you don't have the right clothes, you don't have the right car, you don't live in the right neighborhood, you know, I'm not going to say the R word, but let's face what these school board members are really saying. These kids get more benefit than you would realize by the playing field sociologically and economically being a little more level when they're at school.
Martha, thanks for the call. Martha, getting back to that point about stigma, Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a big, a reason that there's been arguments in favor of universal school meals, and California became the first state actually to authorize universal school meals, and there's a federal bill, currently under consideration that would make these temporary programs essentially permanent, and would otherwise expand access to meals, and the reason for that is exactly this. It really does level the playing field quite a lot for disadvantaged kids, and that matters. That really matters a lot.
Thanks for the call, Andrew. Just in our last minute, what are you watching for now to see if these universal lunch programs take off either at the federal level or if a growing number of states take that on?
Yeah, I mean, certainly California passing legislation like that is a big deal. And I believe Maine did as well, although I'd have to double check that. And so that's already a significant amount of momentum in that direction. And historically, this is exactly where we got federal school meal programs from in the first place, is due to the Depression and a similar kind of emergency where a number of people, were plunged into poverty rather suddenly. And so there's real precedent for a sort of emergency situation like this becoming a more permanent solution. So we're currently in the child nutrition reauthorization period, which happens every 5 years. So this is an excellent time to reach out to your representatives and encourage them to support universal free meal bill and also other child nutrition support bills.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Ruiz is Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the UW Center for Education Research. He joins us for a look at school meal programs in Wisconsin and around the country. Coming up, anger is part of being human, and we have the power to use it for good or bad reasons. Wisconsin psychologist tells us the story of anger, how to manage it, with his book, Why We Get Mad. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. What if you had a tool that could energize you to solve problems, release your creativity, and advocate for yourself and others already in your hands? Our next guest says that when channeled properly, anger can serve those purposes and more. Anger is usually seen as a negative emotion, and it can lead to real and serious problems. But it doesn't always have to be a bad thing. We're going to revisit a conversation now with a Wisconsin psychology expert who says we can treat anger as a motivator and the first step toward a positive change, and we can learn to recognize and address it when it's having a negative impact on our lives. Ryan Martin is professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. He writes about anger and emotion at alltheragescience.com. His new book is called Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. We talked to him back in January. Here's a listen back to that conversation. Ryan, I've talked to you about anger on and off over the years, really, but I don't think I've ever asked, what got you so interested in the study of this particular emotion?
Yeah, that's a great question. So like a lot of people, it's rooted in what I experienced growing up. And so I'll start by saying that I was, and I talk about this in the book, I was raised with an angry parent. My dad experienced a lot of anger, not usually directed at me, but directed at other people. And it was something that I experienced a lot when I was growing up, and ultimately at times led to a little bit of a rift in our relationship, and that I didn't always feel super comfortable around him. That led into me in college studying psychology and thinking about, anger as the experience a lot of people deal with. I worked with at-risk adolescents at the time, and I saw a lot of them had real serious problems managing their anger. Now, one of the things I realized since then, though, is how these kids were really right to be angry. The world had not treated them very well at all. And I understood, I think, far better why they were so mad. But it was still, you know, causing them a lot of problems, making it difficult for them to be successful. And so I went to graduate school with the goal of studying anger. That was about 20 years ago, and I've been studying it ever since.
You just pointed to some of the negative sides of anger, how they can affect our relationships, the people around us, get in the way of our lives in a lot of ways. But you also point out that we can use anger in positive ways. It can motivate us to do good things. Can you talk about the what people might not always think of as the positive potential of anger?
Yeah, and I think it's important to note exactly what anger is for people, because I think sometimes a lot of the confusion comes from thinking of it as the same as aggression or violence. And so thinking of it as the same as some of the behaviors associated with it. But anger it's just a feeling state. In a lot of ways, it's very similar to fear or to sadness or even to happiness, as far as it's this emotional experience that people have, that everyone has. And the way it can be valuable is that from an evolutionary perspective, it exists because it is alerting you to injustice, and then it's energizing you to confront that injustice. So it's one of the ways that your brain essentially lets you know that you've been wronged and then provides you some energy to deal with that. It's not unlike the same way, you know, fear is one of the ways your brain alerts you to the fact that you're in danger, and then it energizes you to flee. It's a very similar emotional experience to that.
You've got a practical exercise in the book for people who have problems, big or small, with anger. Maybe it's just, oh, I wish I hadn't snapped at that person the other day, or I have a consistent problem with anger, or whatever. You have kind of, it's almost like an incident report after a plane crash or something like that. Talk about how we can evaluate an instance of anger in our lives in a way to understand our own anger.
Yeah, this is one of the exercises I have students do in my classes, and then I brought it into the book. And it's really, I encourage people to essentially what we call diagram an angry incident. And what I mean by that is I want them to think broadly about what led to their anger in that moment. And so, you know, people have a tendency to think things that it's a very linear relationship. Something made them mad, or I got mad because of this. But in reality, you know, their anger emerged from this complicated set of experience. It's a precipitant. It's a spark, a provocation, if you will. But it's also their mood at the time of that precipitant, at the time of that provocation. So were they stressed? Were they hungry? Were they tired? But then it's also how they evaluated it, how they judged it, how they appraised it. And so putting these things together leads to that angry feeling that tends to respond, come from that. And then even from that, there's how we deal with it, what we do with that anger. Do we go sit in our room and pout? Do we yell and scream? Do we type at people in all caps on the internet? Or do we channel it into something productive? Do we have a difficult conversation? Do we create art? There's all sorts of options, in fact, infinite options. And so what I encourage people to do is think about incidents in those ways, angry incidents in those ways. And then from that, actually doing that over time, you might just start to see patterns emerge. You might start to see a particular expression style or a particular thought type or even a particular mood state that you're in when it happens.
We're talking to Ryan Martin, psychologist at UW Green Bay, talking about his book, Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. That's out today. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. Let's go to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you. I think of anger as a vibration. When I was growing up in a dysfunctional family, I experienced anger from other people. And I studied the Bible, and Jesus got mad at the money changers in the temple. So I learned that anger wasn't necessarily bad, but it was a choice. And it could also be a source of passion. And I met a priest once who said that it takes a lot of love to get angry, but it's still a choice. And I wonder, can anger empower people to a better life, or is it something like myself? I withdraw and I pray through it. We all get angered. We're all human. But do you see it as a positive in that way?
Interesting. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is valuable. And, you know, we use a lot of different metaphors for anger. One of the metaphors I really like for anger is that it's a fuel, and that it's that fuel that, like any fuel, can cause problems. It can explode and it can be dangerous. But it can also provide energy, and it can also help you motivate you toward that sort of positive change that the caller was talking about.
Thanks for that call, by the way. How do we, I guess, avoid the negative, impulsive reaction to anger and channel it in some other way? I guess take a pause through prayer, as in Jeff's case, or maybe sitting back or distract yourself. I don't know what. What kind of things can we do to make sure we don't do that gut response that's something angry or violent or escalating, and use it in a more positive way instead?
Yeah, this is a great question. It's one I get all the time. And the best answer is ultimately sort of two things. One is some intentionality, and that people in their non-angry life, so when they're not angry, have to be thoughtful and have to be intentional about saying, I don't want to blow up. I don't want that to happen. I don't want to be that person. And so they have to make that decision. And it's usually best to make that decision when they're not angry. And then again, when they're not angry, start thinking through some strategies that work for them, or that could work for them in those angry moments. And so, you know, you mentioned a few there, but it could be a moment of counting to three. It might be a moment of just taking a deep breath. It might be actually letting out a long sigh or something along those lines that help people. Just that little pause helps people sort of come to grips with where they're at and start to think through things more clearly.
Thanks for calling in, Jeff. We're talking to Ryan Martin, UW Green Bay psychology professor. His new book is Why We Get Mad: How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the things, if you're willing to share this, that make you mad, angry in a negative way? Or have you found ways when you get angry to channel it, to motivate good things to happen in your life? Do you have questions about anger, how it works, what it does, how we can get it under control? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Ryan Martin, UW Green Bay psychology professor, looking at his new book, Why We Get Mad: How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, maybe experiences in dealing with anger. Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hey, guys. So I love this program. I've been through some behavioral therapy throughout the years, a couple of years, and one of the things I learned that I really liked was that only you can control your emotions and nobody else can make you feel a certain way. And even though I was never really an angry person, that really helped me out control my emotions more and make me feel better as a person, knowing that if I don't get mad or if I don't show my emotions, because I'm the one that's in control of them and no one else can make me feel that way. And another thing I also like is that why get angry if it doesn't serve a purpose?
Interesting, Michael. Thanks a lot for sharing both those thoughts. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, I like that a lot. You know, and I do want to, I guess, when people embrace the very linear "I got mad because" approach to things, when they think of things as, well, this made me mad, it really does take a lot of the power away from the person, a lot of the control away from the person, because it seems inevitable, right? I got mad because this happened. So what I like to think about and why how I like to approach anger is to think about all of the different aspects of this that you can control, that we can take better care of ourselves physically to limit the number of times we're feeling stressed or hungry or tired so that we're less likely to snap in those situations. We can control at least some of the provocations we choose to experience day in and day out. We can, we have some choice about the types of thoughts we have and how we choose to evaluate things and judge things. And so, I sometimes want to be careful about the idea of saying that we have complete choice over our emotions. You know, we develop patterns over our life that are hard to control, but I also do think we have more control in these situations than we give ourselves credit for.
Thanks, Michael, for calling in. That reminds me, Ryan, you talk a lot about some of the ways we think when we're angry that could kind of be force multipliers in terms of our anger. I want to hit on at least a couple of those. One of them is overgeneralizing, and you give a couple examples in the book. Why do I always hit every red light? Or if a coworker does something you don't like, they do that every time. Talk about overgeneralizing as a thing that may reinforce that initial feeling of anger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, overgeneralizing is one that is actually, I think, relatively easy to identify in our thoughts because it does use those words like you described, always, never, every time, and so on. And what happens is that, so let's say I get stopped by a stoplight and I'm running late for work or something. And if I start saying, oh, this happens to me every day or every morning, instead of thinking of this as just a singular incident, I started to think about this as a pattern, right? This isn't just a thing that's happened just right now that's going to delay me for 2 minutes. It's a thing that's going to happen or that's happened every day or happens all the time that delays me often. And that's a much bigger problem. And so we tend to blow these problems, out of perspective that way.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Darlene is with us in River Falls. Hi, Darlene.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about?
I grew up always thinking that, you know, it was just a terrible thing to throw trash out of your car and litter. And I've been spending a lot of time lately in Milwaukee, and I'm going to be moving there eventually. And driving through the streets, I'd see all of this trash along the roadway. And I kept getting angry about it and just thinking how terrible it was. And finally, I just asked myself, well, what am I going to do about my anger? And so I started picking up trash. My husband lives in Milwaukee, and he's got this, you know, he gets his trash collected once a week and barely throws anything out. And so I thought, well, here's this trash collection that I could be adding a couple bags of trash every week to it. And so I started doing that. And
it
made me feel better. It's like a relief has been lifted off of my shoulders, just taking the anger away from me.
I love it, Darlene. Thank you so much for sharing that. And Ryan, so not only is she finding a way to divert her anger, she's finding a way that actually solves the cause of her anger.
Yep, and that is a really nice way of channeling anger into a positive solution. And, you know, ultimately, our anger, one of the things it tells us is that we have a problem, that there's something interfering in our goals or interfering in the way we want things to be. And so taking steps to channel that anger into a solution to that problem is a really good, smart way to deal with anger.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate your sharing that with us. Let's go now to Karen in Fort Atkinson. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thank you for being there on this topic. I'd like to bring it into the context of current events. I was a member of a religious cult for 6 years. And so there, in that occurs brainwashing, authoritarianism, totalitarianism. And you're being told lies and what to believe in. So as what happened last week, there are many people out there who believe those lies, believe a certain thing, and therefore they are angry and legitimately, because they believe those lies, feel they have a right to be angry. But then how do you you know, get through to that, turn that around, and then more importantly, not just with an individual, because I did the programming of people in cults, but with a society.
Karen, interesting points. Ryan, a worldview, a cult worldview in Karen's case or others, leading to anger when you run up against reality.
Yeah, this is a really good point and a good question. I think first, you know, one of the challenges we have, one of the first steps to understanding and dealing with our anger is making a decision about whether or not we should be mad. Meaning, have we truly been objectively wronged? And that requires a certain level of emotional maturity. It requires a certain mental amount of intellectual capacity that not everyone is capable of. I think it also requires that people sort of want to actually give some thought to this and consider this and ask themselves if they've been wronged. And not everyone wants to do that. Some people would rather be angry than actually take the time to investigate it. And I think that ultimately there's nothing that can be done until a person wants to. I think somehow we've got to find a way to help people get to a place where they actually want to think about whether or not they have been wronged or whether or not they are in the wrong.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. Talking to Ryan Martin about his new book, Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. Ryan, for people, you know, who just have that occasional anger problem, maybe it's not a chronic everyday thing, but that there are moments in their lives that they don't like, they want to try to be better about it, more productive with their anger. What are some steps you'd suggest they take home with them today?
Yeah, I think the first question I would encourage them to ask is sort of, when I have those moments, what are they telling me about myself and about the situation I'm in? I think one of the goals should be this level of self-reflection where we try to help understand ourselves or use our anger to better understand ourselves. And once we've done that, once we've understood, so what does my anger tell me about the situation I'm in? What does it tell me about the kind of person I am and what I value? Once we've done that, we can start to think through some next steps, like how do I manage it? Now that I know this, now that I have a sense for the types of provocations that tend to lead to my anger, how can I manage those provocations? How can I manage the way I think about things or the angry feelings I'm having in this moment? How can I channel that into something productive so that it doesn't get the best of me, hurt me, or hurt the people around me?
And briefly, going back to something you mentioned earlier, the time to do that is not while I'm angry, but I guess while I'm not angry, so I can plan for the next time.
Absolutely. You want to do some of this work when you're not angry, because it's just more likely to carry into those angry moments later on. If you've had those thoughts with yourself, when you're not angry, it becomes much easier to remember them in those angry moments.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. He writes about anger and emotion at alltheragescience.com. We listen back to a conversation we had with him earlier this year about his latest book, Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. If you have an experience or thought about how to deal with anger, we'd still love to hear it. If you found a way to channel your anger in positive directions, do you have a method for calming down and taking a step back when you do feel angry? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know, or email ideas@WPR.org. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 7, an international report looks at the impact of climate change on children around the world. You can hear the findings and join in with your thoughts and questions tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then pandemic unemployment programs created at the height of job losses last year are set to end in less than a week. We'll talk to an expert in safety net policies about how that could impact the millions still receiving that aid around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.